Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to have the chance to give this talk. Listening around the introductions, I heard the word statistical physics terrifyingly often. It reminded me of the fact that I once knew some statistical physics, and my last paper in statistical physics was published a quarter of a century ago, so that is, for me at least, a scary comment. What I want to do in this talk is to present work from a number of different ecological applications with the common theme that some of the simple models that are used in mathematical biology ought to be taken seriously, are capable of making genuine quantitative predictions, and can therefore form the basis for a further elaboration, but that there is considerable subtlety involved in the business of matching models to data. And in the abstract, that's perhaps a fairly obvious message. When you come to specific cases, it's in a sense, each problem raises its own peculiarities, and I want to talk about just one or two of them. Ecological modeling, why has that not? Ecological modeling covers a lot of different questions, and I know a number of you have been thinking about I'll actually take it, then I can point with it on occasions. Covers questions at a lot of different levels of ecological organization. The standard textbook definition of ecology, I guess, is something like the study of the interaction of living organisms with their environment. And in that context, ecologists study individuals with particular emphasis on physiology and behavior, and how that, in a sense, how individuals respond to their environment. They study populations, which are collections of individuals. They study communities, which, if you like, are collections of interacting populations. And they study ecosystems. And to some extent, ecosystems and communities are concerned with the same systems, but with different questions in mind. And ecosystem ecologists commonly focus on the flow of energy and elemental matter, whereas the community ecologists tend to talk about competition, predation, and so on. It's a pretty artificial distinction, and I don't want to labor it. Yeah.
The individual and population of individual people are usually mean, or individuals today are usually mean like birds and or foxes,
I mean an individual organism of whatever size. In fact, in the cases I'm going to talk about today, one of the interacting species are microalgae. So you're talking about a single-celled organism, perhaps 10, 15 microns in diameter. But equally, it could be an elephant or a blue whale. So in fact, that's a nice lead-in to the point at the bottom of the transparency, which is that I think the aim of many ecologists is to achieve some level of generality in ecological theory. And the premise that lies behind a lot of the work that I and colleagues here have been doing is that you can build up some reasonably general theory of population dynamics that is based on the physiology of individuals and is sufficiently general that it lets you extrapolate or move out, as it were, to the level of communities and ecosystems, which is where a lot of the problems of greatest environmental interest reside. In short, the aim of a lot of the work I'm involved in, and that I'm going to talk about this morning, is about linking these different levels of ecological organization. I'm going to talk mainly about the individual to population link. I'm going to duck the community aspect, except for about three transparencies, and I'm going to have one slide on ecosystems that, again, just points to the possibility of going out in that direction. Ecological models generally get a bad press. Everybody dislikes them, and they dislike them for a number of different reasons. Many ecologists would have been jumping at me already after what I've said with these remarks about general theory. They'd have said, no, you can't. The whole point about ecology is that nature is complex, that every system has its own peculiarities, and these peculiarities are important. So against that philosophy, many ecologists particularly distrust the simple dynamic models that we use in mathematical modeling, just because they are simple, and argue that they miss out a lot of important and interesting biology. And of course, they're right. Secondly, mathematical biologists and physicists that work with dynamical systems distrust complex simulations, which are the other kind of model that are used a lot in ecology, in a sense because they don't understand the dynamics. It's hard enough to tease out the dynamics of a three-variable ordinary differential equation system, and when somebody couples together 2,000 and asks you to believe the results, they get worried about all kinds of questions. Finally, there's a lot of ecological statisticians trying to apply models in ecology, and they worry about a whole collection of problems related to fitting nonlinear models to data and so on. So there are concerns from all the different directions that people come. In the particular context of the tension between simple versus complex models, a traditional resolution that has achieved quite a lot of recognition is to contrast simple models, which are regarded as strategic, was the phrase Bob May used about a quarter of a century ago, and it's stuck. It means they guide insight, but they're not to be taken too seriously. They're certainly not to be regarded as objects for quantitative test, to be contrasted with complex simulations, which perhaps could be tested. And there's an argument that you build up a suite of models of different levels of complexity and thereby get some insight. In this talk, I want to argue a somewhat different picture, that properly interpreted, some of the simple models really can be tested and can give you insight. In other words, the models do deserve some respect, and we ought to therefore take them reasonably seriously. I want to organize the presentation as follows. I'm going to start by showing a set of simplifications that you can make to some standard equations that describe physiologically structured population models in a way that yields some of the standard ordinary differential equations that are used in elementary population dynamic theory and that form the building blocks for some of the evolutionary and coevolutionary issues that this group, I believe, has been addressing. I'm going to demonstrate that a lot of what's done is testable by constant reference to some work that we're involved in related to the population dynamics of the water flea Daphnia. I want to say just a little, and this is perhaps aimed in part at establishing generality, I want to say just a little bit about the fact that the same ideas can be applied in a practical problem involving competing fish in Carpentaria salt marsh. This is the one slide I promised that will say that you could say something about ecosystems, and inevitably there are the closing remarks about all the things we've not done. So let me start by addressing a particular problem of describing a single population interacting with its environment. Many of the really simple population models make the assumptions that all individuals are identical and treat them a bit like molecules, have state variables, which are number of individuals, and so on. And these models can very quickly run into trouble. One of the commonest arguments you hear is that ecological models should take account of age structure and size structure of the population. And there's a standard formalism for doing this. We introduce a density function, n of t and a, which represents the density of individuals aged a at time t, more precisely n times a small integral dA is the number of individuals in that a small interval. I assume deterministic growth of the organism such that it's possible to say for an individual with a given age at a given time what its size would be. And if this variable W, which represents the size, this could be dry weight, carbon content, whatever, of an individual aged A at time T. Let me temporarily jump over this section and talk about the equations that N and W describe. The temporal evolution of N is particularly simple. In a sense, life aging is simply a progression along a conveyor belt to death. So the equation that describes the temporal evolution of N is just the equation that you would think of as describing advection in a one-dimensional system, with a loss term representing death, and mu is a per capita mortality rate. For the time being, it can depend on anything. But the next slide will tighten things up a bit. The equation describing the temporal evolution of W is just saying that dW dt is negative dW dA plus a term that represents the growth rate of an individual organism as it ages. And I imagine that this is the product of two terms. The first term is what I call the net production rate. That's the rate at which the individual organism is accumulating biomass. So it's assimilation rate minus respiration rate, if you're thinking in terms of dry weight or carbon, multiplied by a quantity that I've called theta, which represents the proportion of the net production that is assigned to growth. Because an organism can, in principle, apply the energy, its net production, to either growth or to respiration. So to either growth or to reproduction, I should say. So it can produce new body with the surplus energy it's got, or it could produce eggs, or any other variant depending on its reproductive peculiarities. This pair of PDEs gets to be solved in general with boundary conditions. The boundary condition on weight is pretty trivial, provided you assume that all individuals are the same size at birth. The boundary condition on N is more complicated and provides feedback through reproduction. This integral represents an integral over all ages. 1 minus theta of W is the proportion of assimilate that an individual of size W assigns to reproduction. This is the rate at which it's accumulating energy from reproduction. This is the density function. And this is scaling by the weight of an individual at birth. So this is a reasonably standard a set of equations for describing a size-structured population. Nonlinearities can enter through the dependence of P, theta, and mu on either the state variables of the system, W or A, or on the environment. And in particular, these will in some circumstances depend on the environment. For a wide range of models, you can put these equations pretty painlessly up in a computer and you can solve them and you can get simulations of your population. What I want to do here is detail a set of simplifying assumptions that let you go from these equations to the standard or to the simple equations that sometimes appear as purportedly describing biological populations. And the assumptions are detailed here. I assume that an individual consumer moves randomly in space, searches for a resource of constant density, that this resource is distributed uniformly or randomly in space. I assume that the search rate of an individual is directly proportional to its own biomass. I assume that the effects of satiation, that's the fact that the organism can't eat food infinitely fast, is characterized by what ecologists commonly call a type 2 functional response, what biochemists call a Michaelis-Menten kinetic. It's just a standard hyperbolic curve that goes along and flattens out like that. And critically, I assume that the half-saturation constant in that curve is independent of size or age for the organism. That's not as dumb as it sounds, because when you work through the theory of the functional response, the theory of feeding, you discover that the half-saturation constant is related to the product of the search rate and the handling time per food item. Search rate will basically go up as you get bigger. Handling time per food item will go down as you get bigger. If you multiply something that's going up with weight with something that's going down by weight and say a prayer, you get something that is constant and independent of weight. It's certainly not as crazy an assumption as it might appear. I assume a constant conversion efficiency of ingested food into biomass. So that's to say, there's the same conversion efficiency of ingested food, whether the endpoint is somatic tissue or reproductive tissue. It's just a constant fixed proportion. Here now I answer the question from before, which is that although not required for the general formalism, for the simplification that I'm making, I assume that all organisms have a constant age and mass independent death rate. This is I'll comment on that assumption in just a minute. And finally, I assume that consumers lose biomass through respiration at a constant specific rate. That just says there's a constant daily rate in keeping a cell alive, and that is represented by this constant B, which is the units of reciprocal time. If I put these assumptions together, what I get is that what I call the net production, which is assimilation minus maintenance for an individual, is given by this expression here. I max R over R plus RH, that's just the type 2 functional response, multiplied by the conversion efficiency. This is the assimilation rate, that's the respiration rate, and it's multiplied by the weight of the individual. This entire transparency describes assumptions about individuals, not about populations. In order to make the transition, so P can be negative, and P represents negative P represents an individual that is losing weight. And I'll make a remark about that at the very end of the talk. I can now, in a straightforward way, write down an expression for the total biomass of the consumers. It takes this form. And provided I allow, and I mean that question was actually a nice lead in here, provided I allow negative a negative weight loss and significant negative weight loss, I can differentiate this equation. When I differentiate through the integral sign, I get the NDT, dW dt terms. You crank the handle for about half a page, and you discover that the dynamics of the total consumer biomass, which is now a population property, is given by this ordinary differential equation, which is very, very like one that you encounter in standard population ecology textbooks, with a couple of differences. First, the state variable is the biomass and not the number of individuals in the population. And secondly, the loss rate is the combination of death rate and respiration, and not just the death rate. This is a particularly fortuitous outcome because of all the assumptions that I put up on the previous slide. None of them would be particularly appealing to ecologists, but the one that would attract the greatest ire would be the one about death rate being age and size independent, because that's really a blatant lie for just about any organism you can think of. However, for a lot of organisms, the rate at which material is lost through respiration is greater than the rate at which it's lost through mortality. So the effect on the population dynamics is weakened because your bad assumption appears in combination with a good assumption. In the example we're going to look at, this parameter for Daphne, this parameter turns out to be typically around 0.1 per reciprocal day, which, if you like, says a carbon atom has a residence time of about 10 days inside a Daphnia. this is about 0.02 or 0.03, so this is 5 times smaller than that, even though the assumptions about this are pretty dreadful. Their effect is reduced. This then tells us that the total consumer biomass can be described by an ordinary differential equation, and that all the parameters in this equation relate to properties of individuals. You use this in applications by coupling this equation, or one like it, with dynamic equation or equations that describe how the resource changes over time. And a lot of different equations are used to describe the resource. I've just given 3 here that will appear in a number of situations. You could assume that there is a constant supply of resource in the system, so it's being supplied at a constant rate denoted by big phi. This just says the rate of change of the resource is the supply rate minus the consumption rate. Another possibility, and this, I should have put parentheses in here, this goes with transfer culture. A lot of biologists do experiments, especially on small organisms, where they, and the water fleas I'm going to talk about are an example, they grow them in little containers which are, you know, which contain a fixed amount of food, and then every day, every couple of days, depending how energetic they are, they transfer the organisms to new food. So you now actually have a dynamically varying environment, but it's a dynamically varying environment where the dynamics are created by the experimentalist, not by nature, by just the practicality, the fact that the practicalities of keeping food density constant are hard, and so they do a lot of experiments in these transfer culture containers. And then the resource dynamics are given by this equation, which only contains a loss term, but if you like, with a resetting of the initial conditions for R every at regular intervals, and this gives you another form of dynamics. And finally, you can assume self-reproducing food in which the food grows logistically, the consumption is as before. Actually, I should have had that. That's a goof on my part. I copy-pasted from another slide. That should be an IMAX in there. It's just meant to be the same as that. If you couple this equation with the previous consumer equation, you get a pair of equations often referred to by ecologists as the Rosenzweig-MacArthur model. I'm going to mention that because I think Rosenzweig's here later on in the week. And it's a nice simple model with a reasonably rich repertoire of dynamics that has been used to look at a lot of consumer resource systems. I'm mentioning it here because what I've just done shows you that it's got this conceptual basis in psi-structured population dynamics, and therefore could be tested on the basis of these assumptions. So what I'm now going to do is say just a little bit about the testing, and this is work which has been done by a gang of 5 of us over a disturbingly large number of years. Ed McCauley is an ecologist at the University of Calgary, and he's done a lot of the experiments. Andrew DeRose and Bill Gurney are 2 other theorists that have been involved in this. Bill Murdoch is an ecologist here at UCSB, and it was experimental work by him in the early 80s that raised some of the questions from which this follows. This is a picture of the key player in this system, the water flea Daphnia. Focus on the bottom picture here. This represents a small individual, perhaps 2 or 2.5 millimeters in length here. Daphnia are an important component of the zooplankton in a lot of temperate lakes and ponds. So they're ecologically important in the sense that they act as a major filtration agent. Daphnia are the reason that a lot of lakes have clear water in summer and fall and not not murky, turbid water. This young lady, perhaps 2 millimeters long, 2.5 millimeters long, can filter 200 milliliters of water in a day. So a lot of water gets filtered by a small Daphnia. And Daphne are convenient for population dynamic studies for a number of reasons. First, there's a lot of data available. This is because they're used in a lot of ecotoxicological studies. Various people, either funded by or meeting requirements from the EPA, are growing Daphne in water with just about every poison you can think of added to it. So there's a lot of information on the physiology of Daphnia. For much of the year, they reproduce parthenogenetically, so you don't, from population dynamics, have to worry about the problems of sex. It's just the males are surplus to requirements and are cut out as an unnecessary middleman. At the end of the year, Daphnia may reproduce sexually, first produce eggs, and then males, and then produce resting eggs. A resting egg is illustrated up here. It's an example. That's a pair of resting eggs. There, you could think of them as like seeds in a seed bank. They get dropped at the end of the season into the bottom of the lake and sit there, perhaps reappearing the following year, perhaps waiting even longer. I'm only going to talk about processes over a short enough time scale that we think about this stage. There, growth is relatively simple. The animal is filtering the water. It's getting food from the microalgae that are in the water. It's using some of this energy for growth, some of it to produce eggs. It puts the eggs in a brood, in a little brood, so-called brood pouch or backpack on her back. Every two or three days she molts, releases the eggs as now fully formed neonates into the environment, and the process repeats itself. Individuals continue growing past maturity, so they have both growth and reproduction occurring as adults. They typically have many broods as an adult, so it's an organism that you could reasonably argue you can get away with treating through continuous time modeling of the sort that I'm describing. Though in fact, we've set up some molt-by-molt simulations to address that question. We have set up detailed models of growth and reproduction in Daphnia, which are not what I want to talk about in this talk. What I want to show now are two slides that say that the grotesque assumptions that I made in the previous piece of work are actually reasonably consistent with observed patterns of growth and reproduction in Daphnia. So the next two graphs describe the properties of individuals in a bottle. So these are individuals living in 100 milliliter containers transferred to fresh food every 2 days, I think it was, in Ed McCauley's lab. I treated the function theta of W, which described the partitioning of energy or from food to growth versus reproduction, as an unknown fitting function which I was allowed to adjust. And then I fitted data on growth at four food levels, which are what you see here. And these are individual measurements for about 10 individuals in each case. And the error bars represent plus or minus the standard error on these. And the next slide tells you something about cumulative reproduction. That's cumulative eggs, say at day 30, means the total number of eggs that have been produced by day 30. What you see is that the model, in spite of its simplifications, does not too badly, except for the largest individuals, except for the oldest individuals in the highest food. It turns out that very few individuals in nature ever experience this high food environment. Consequently, the model as a representation of individuals is not too bad over much of the range of environments for which they are observed. So in spite of its simplicity, the model is not too far from what is observed.
So how many independent people are there?
The only reason that is let's go back a slide and That's a slightly tricky question for the following reason, which is that I've done it a number of different ways. The most of the independent parameters are in this unknown function that characterizes the partitioning of energy between growth and reproduction. I have, for most of the work, I use a spline with five knots, but I vary the number of degrees of freedom. For the purposes of validating this transition to population dynamics, where the function theta drops out, these degrees of freedom are not too important. Beyond that, I have the parameter Imax that I described. I have the half saturation constant. I have the respiration rate, and that's a. What else do I have? These are the main ones, and we have a test on the fitting, which is that you can now look at what you get. A number of these rate parameters have been measured independently, and if I was giving a talk about Daphne, I would jump down purely about Daphne, I would jump down that track. The reason I'm being a little cavalier here is that for the purposes of the present presentation, it actually doesn't matter critically whether this is now let me start that sentence again. What really matters is that the fit we get is consistent with observation over a reasonably wide range of food densities, though, as you see, not the highest. There's a separate set of issues which actually regard true testing of the model. Let me say I'm describing this as a fit and not a test. And if you want to follow that up at the end of the talk, I can happily actually say a little bit about testing models of individuals, because that's something else that we're involved in. But that involves getting back at the individual physiological rates, which I'm not talking about. This is a not particularly good example of but it was the one I had on my computer, so I pasted it on, of an example of the kind of data that you can get keeping populations in the lab. Ed ran very many population experiments. This is one which was kept in a lab culture. The individuals were transferred to fresh food. The populations were now transferred to fresh food every Monday, Wednesday, Friday. So it was a slightly complicated 2-2-3 transfer regime dictated by the fact that technicians didn't work at weekends. And this is a picture of the adult population density. This is the juveniles. This is the total carbon. There was a glitch in the food supply about day 80 or 90, so I suggest we focus purely on the right-hand half of this picture, and I ask you to take on trust the fact that I have quite a number of more recent pictures from more recent experiments, which are sitting as scraps of paper in my office that I should have put up here, which say that this kind of pattern carries on as a reasonable stable equilibrium to at least 150 or 160 days. So all I want from this is to argue that the total carbon per liter, the total biomass, settles to some kind of steady level. Now I ask, can I predict what that level would be? Everyone, a number of, it's a few hundred. So it's about 200 adults, 500 juveniles, so 700 per liter. And these, I should add, are higher densities than are typically observed in nature. This is because the actual density you see is determined by the rate at which food is being supplied by the experimenter, and the experimenter here was performing primary production faster than nature does. 10 to 50 per liter would be more typical in even a pretty rich lake. All I want to say about the parameters is that we have collected estimates of these parameters for two species of Daphnia, a relatively small species. These are from experiments in the literature. This is the species that ed studies. You can get values for both of these, as I say, from direct measurements of respiration. Mortality is estimated from mean lifetime. Assimilation efficiency from primarily radiotracer experiments. This from feeding experiments. This from feeding experiments. All that matters here is there's no population studies have gone into that. Let me jump to that picture for a second. And you now take the dynamic equations that I've that I've put up, and for the set of experiments that I showed you, and two others from the literature, from experiments by Clyde Goulden and collaborators, you can get an estimate which probably carries confidence intervals of about plus or minus 25 to 30%. So I don't believe any of these numbers to better than 30%. But these are the values that are estimated. If I take my previous model with the constant food supply, I predict these values. If I take the model with the fluctuating food supply, which in turn gives you a dynamic that looks something like this, the biomass is dynamically fluctuating, and in particular, the organism goes from very rapidly from glut to famine, I make actually only a small change to the predicted average level. So what that tells you is that you can go from individual to population, provided you work with the most boring population imaginable. That's individuals in a bottle in the lab with the food supply determined by the experimenter. In a sense, it's an energy-based model. The experimenter is determining how much energy comes in, and hence it's not too surprising that you get the densities about right. If we got that wrong, it would be really bad news. It would have said we couldn't even do mass balance. Typical age is probably about 30 days. So there's so these experiments ran for about 6 or 7 generations. And first reproduction occurs at anything from 6 to 20 days, depending on the food supply, and probably on average is taking place about 12 or 14 days after birth. So you're probably seeing I mean, these are very smeared generations, and you're seeing anything from 5 to 15 in maybe 5 to 10 in this type of experiment. Far more interesting is whether we can get at something beyond simple equilibria. And I now want to refer to the results of two situations that show that you can. Clyde Goulden and collaborators, in a paper that's now been out for rather a long time, did a study of competition between two types of zooplankton, Daphnia and a smaller animal called Bosmina. Simple competition theory, which I know a number of people here have been looking at, says that if you have two consumers feeding in a single resource, coexistence is impossible, and the outcome and the winner is the winner is determined by parameters that relate to the properties of the individuals and not to of the individual consumers and not to the food supply rate. And hence the justification for using these models as the basis of evolutionary studies, because you can now talk about whether these parameters are adaptive. What that means is that if you change the food supply regime according to this traditional theory, you should not change the winner in a competition experiment. Goulden and collaborators ran two regimes. They used low food with 2-day transfers, high food with 4-day transfers. The experiments didn't run for long enough for us to know whether coexistence occurred, but there was certainly a major qualitative difference. In the low food treatments, Bosmina dominated. In the high food treatments, Daphnia dominated. They have different values for these parameters, but you're able to get it. You're able to get at the parameter set that I've put up for Daphnia. You're able to get at the analogous parameter set for Bosmina, again from experiments on individuals. So we've got a parameter set in which we have reasonable confidence for both these competitors. The result, the two consumers persisting in a single resource cannot coexist at equilibrium, is something that you can prove on the basis of a reasonably general argument. And again, if anyone's interested, I can put that on the board at the end of the talk.
Can you repeat what's behind the theory that gives that these two should be the dominant?
Okay, can I put this up for just a second and a. Suppose I had a system with a resource R, and I had an equation for dr dt, an equation for two consumers dc1 dt is something, dc2 dt is something. I now, in a way, I know that a number of you have been talking about, I address the question of coexistence as follows. I imagine that C2 is missing from the system, and I ask what would be the equilibrium achieved by R and C1 alone? I assume for the time being that this is stable. I now ask, could C2 invade? And what that does is gets me a condition for dc2 dt, is a collection of quantities involving C2 and R. So this is function of R only in here. In particular, C1 does not appear if it's pure resource competition. So now what that says is that this individual can invade if its population or its biomass can grow at the equilibrium level set by the other species. So now you go to species C2 and you ask at what food level can it exist? And you discover that the species that wins in competition is the species that can replace itself at the lowest equilibrium food density, and that coexistence is not possible except for the pathological circumstance in which the equilibrium density of resource corresponding to C1 alone and the equilibrium density corresponding to C2 alone happen to be equal to each other, and that's a just numerical accident.
But does that work around the solving R has explicit dependence?
No, that's exactly where we're going. The argument fails if R has time dependence, whether that is whether it's externally or internally generated. And there's a lot of literature that has looked at the situation where it's internally generated. You imagine that the dynamics of these two systems and their own give you a set of limit cycles, and now you ask, can this species invade the limit cycling system, and effectively you get yourself a set of Lyapunov exponent computations, and that gives you, and under certain circumstances, you can get coexistence. If I can bring this down again, that's... That question has anticipated actually beautifully where we're going. The point about... Is this coming up? It turns out that you can actually handle this calculation semi-analytically. And the reason for that is you saw in the previous picture that in these transfer cultures, typically the organisms suck the food down to very, very close to zero. If I assume that the organism sucks the food level actually down to zero rather than to a fraction of a pixel away from zero, I can actually get the invasion conditions to be integrable and can do all the integrals. And what you find is that the winner in the competition is determined by a dimensionless ratio, which is the ratio of the half-saturation constant for the particular species divided by the, what I'm calling the nominal food concentration. That's the food concentration to which the animal is transferred every 2 or 4 days. Varying the nominal food concentration amounts to shifting the operating point up and down the 45-degree line in or up and down a line of constant slope, at least, in that picture. And it's when you then put for the other parameters, the physiological parameters relating to the organism in question, you find that Bosmina is predicted to win at low food and Daphne is predicted to win at higher food. The relevant, I'm showing this in order to make the point that the really simple model, now taken away from equilibrium into a situation where you're dealing with at least some elementary dynamics, which is that there's externally forced oscillations, is again generating predictions that are in agreement with observations. So the model is to some extent testable even in that situation. Yeah. Yes.
Can you say something about waste removal? You can do some chemical war which by one species against the other.
Oh, there are many, many mechanisms by which these organisms can interact. Waste removal in these experiments is probably not an issue because of the way they're performed. They're performed in these so-called transfer cultures, and what that means is that every 2 days, the experimenter actually filters the animals out of the container they're in and puts them into fresh food, leaving at least the particulate and soluble wastes behind. Obviously, there's some waste that is inevitably transferred with the organism, but it's reasonably minimal. And for instance, in these experiments, you typically get no bacterial growth, whereas in many other experiments done in continuous containers, you do get bacterial growth. So in extrapolated from that type of experiment to the real world, there's a whole collection of issues relating to waste and microbial dynamics and so on, but they're probably absent in these systems, which again takes you to the trade-off between realism and testability, which is where we're going. I want to jump on though to the field, because I think the real question that any ecologist would ask is, is any of this stuff of the slightest use in the field? Ed McCauley, one of the people that I mentioned there, and Bill Murdoch about 8 or 9 years ago, did a very thorough literature search and identified a lot of systems for which they could directly measure the proportion of all the algae in a lake that were edible by Daphnia, and that's typically characterized by size. Daphnia can eat algae in a certain size range. And here is a collection of data points. Since this picture was drawn, there's a few more that could be added to it. But these data points came from systems with a wide range of enrichment in the sort of freshwater system that's being looked at here. Typically, the growth of the algae is limited by the availability of phosphorus. So you can do a calculation that translates the amount of phosphorus in the system through to a carrying capacity in the logistic equation of the sort that I showed earlier. And you can then classify these systems as having different values for carrying capacity. You can measure the density of edible algae. The really simple model that I've just put up predicts that edible algal density should be independent of enrichment in these lakes and should have that value there, plus or minus, I don't know, 30-50%, something like that. So fuzzily in this range. With the embarrassing exception of that point, the other systems looked at, and quite a lot of others that we've subsequently looked at, lie at least in this broad band. So what this is telling us, I think, is that we can take, and remember there's no parameters here which were estimated from field data, we can, on the basis of these simple models, go out and understand why the density of algae in a certain size range in a lake is at least within a factor of 2 the value it has. There's obviously all kinds of special biology that is going to determine where you are in this region, why, and clearly something special is going on here. I'm not saying there isn't a lot of interesting biology going on in these lakes. I'm saying that you can get at a testable value going from lab experiments out into the field with this with this kind of prediction and get this kind of agreement. Yes? A lot of these systems do not have predators. That were looked at. Some, you know, they're sort of things like at least 3 or 4 of these. 3, I think, of the data points there come from stock troughs. In many cases, the predators of Daphnia are fish, and they're operating on a different time scale. So we're looking at dynamics here within a season. And the justification for using the 2-variable model rather than the 3-variable model is that the fish dynamics are operating typically in a multi-year time scale. So within a year, you can think of the Daphnia as being, you can think of the fish as imposing an additional background mortality rate. The reason they don't generate a lot more variation than you've seen is the same one as we talked about before. It's the fact that the death rate gets added to the respiration rate. So a doubling of the mortality because of predation only shifts the predicted value here by perhaps 25%. So it's the choice of variable that again has let us get away without being completely thrown by the predation. By the predation issue. I'm going to return to some comments at the very end on Daphne. In particular, there's some wrinkles with this story that I'm covering over at present. I want to just mention briefly, just say a little that shows that this picture of using biomass representations and hence getting testable models is more widely applicable. Yeah. Oh. Yes. Oh, very, very much so. And the point here, I think, is that let me first comment on every parameter except the theta of W. The competition consideration that we talked about previously says that depending on the environment in which it finds itself and the fluctuations that the organism experiences, all the parameters that appear in the dynamic equations are potentially adaptive. Some more so than others, that's to say, the fact that the organism has physiology that requires respiration is to some extent determined by evolutionary events, I don't know, 50 to 100 million years ago or whenever the respiration pathways were established. So there's a limited scope for a Daphnia to make changes there. There's all kinds of scope for adaptive variation in, for instance, the feeding rate, which might come at an additional energetic cost. There's all kinds of possibilities in there. And in the particular case of Daphnia, the resting egg stage that I mentioned adds a complication because you're one of the evolutionary issues is the timing of when it dumps its resting eggs. Because it's like each year is a competition, is a run of a game involving competing clones. And then over the winter, there's another function that says when will you dump your resting eggs, and that in turn determines how many starters you get in next year's competition, and there's issues related to the fitting of the eggs. The theta of W, which you asked about, is tricky. It has it's probably the thing that's had the most attention among, you know, the trade-off of growth versus reproduction gets a lot of attention from evolutionary biologists. In terms of purely determining the average resource density, it doesn't play a huge part, but it does play a critical part in determining the ratio of juveniles to adults. It determines the demography of the population. In turn, that is something that's strongly influenced by predators. And in fact, let me not go there, but there are some interesting variations in the size structure of some of these natural populations. All of which is a very long way of saying yes, almost everything is adaptive, but in different ways. Exactly. And to some extent, that's actually where I'm, more important than the details, that's where I'm really trying to go. I'm trying to get this idea that you can formulate things in a really systematic way as if you were doing based on a lab-based study. You could test them in the lab, then you can move out to the field, and at least in this case that I've shown, what you're getting is still making some sense when you get out to the field. And the motivation for showing the next example, which is an example relating to competing fish, beyond the obvious motives of letting me show you a nice picture of Carpentaria salt marsh, which if nobody has seen it is about 10 miles, 15 miles down the road, is another illustration that you can use some of these ideas to interpret data that is being gathered in a system of genuine environmental interest. This is a photograph of an aerial photograph of Carpentaria salt marsh, which is part of the UC Natural Reserve System. The extent of the marsh is roughly around here, with a conservation area that you can get into and walk around if anyone's interested, just off Ash Avenue in Carpentaria at this end. It's open to the ocean all the year. It gets flooded from rains, typically in the winter. Apart from that, all the water comes from the ocean. A student of mine, also supervised by Sally Holbrook, an ecologist in our department, studied competition between two fish species, Galicthes, which is a mudsucker, and Leptocotus, which is a sculpin. The important difference is the mudsuckers are residents in the marsh. They live there all year, they hibernate to some extent through the winter, but their population is closed. That's to say, the reproduction comes from individuals that are in the marsh. The Leptocotus use the marsh as a nursery area. Young fish come in the spring, use it as a source of nutrition, grow and leave. And so you now have competition between a species that is being supplied from outside and a species that is completely reliant on the marsh for its persistence. And the question is, why has this or similar nursery species that uses as a nursery not competitively excluded these? Now, I don't want to take a lot of time, but we can set up a model which is very, very like the one that you've seen before, only in this case I even went further and got rid of the saturating part of the functional response. So we have the resource, we have the species with the closed life cycle, we have the species with the open life cycle. The same message as before, we can get at many of the parameters in this model. The functional response parameters can be measured from feeding rates of fish. Respiration rates can be measured in the lab. Resource regeneration rates are a problem, and this is again typical of the kind of ecological judgment you have to make. We made the judgment that we didn't know the resource generation rate in Carpentaria salt marsh, but there had been some ecosystem studies in Magoo Lagoon, which is about another 20 miles down the road, just past Oxnard. And we took a value from there and made the assumption that carp would not be too different. The rate at which the open species arrived is an external parameter. Obviously, there's no a priori way of measuring that other than to go out and see how many young arrive each year, and Andy did that. And he did some experiments to estimate background mortality rates. In addition, he did a series of traditional ecological experiments in enclosures that demonstrated that these species genuinely were competing with each other. That's to say, growth of one was slowed by the presence of the other, and so on. These are just graphs that show the kind of data from which the individual measurements came. And you get a condition for coexistence based on the assumption that everything is at equilibrium. And it turns out the open species has a pretty strong stabilizing effect here, so that's a probably not a bad assumption. And it boils down to saying that to persist in the system, the closed species must be the most efficient consumer. We had enough parameters in there to test whether that was the case, and it turned out okay. And I think part of the value of that is that it now gives us a basis for moving on to the questions that ecologists really are more interested in. This says that we have a reasonable set of parameters, that they make some sense, and we can now go on with this from this, oh, that's just establishing the story, and ask a whole lot of the questions, as I say, that people concerned with wetlands are asking about. How is this finding affected by within year and between year variation in recruitment, by intermittent pollution events? For instance, the fact that that once a year there's a huge amount of nutrient gets poured down from all the horticulture in that particular area, from a within year and between year unpredictable fluctuations in pollution. And we can use the model as a basis for thinking about competition in environmental gradients, both along the coast and within a marsh. And we're just beginning to think about ways of asking whether we can use spatially explicit versions of the model to say something about the spatial segregation of the species, what you would expect to find where. And I've shown this really to say that what you can now do is use your simple energetic-based picture as the foundation for going ahead and now constructing a more elaborate simulation, but with perhaps more secure foundations than you would have if you just wrote it down a priori. I promised you a glimpse at ecosystems, and it is going to be just a glimpse of that. But again, I want to make a point, which is that by going with this energetic-based representation, you can make a link with the sort of approach that ecosystem ecologists commonly do, which is to focus on elemental matter. This slide is taken from a study by Bill Gurney, a long-time colleague of mine in Scotland. He and a number of others looked at ecosystem dynamics in Scottish sea lochs, which are fjord ecosystems in the west coast of Scotland, typically very deep, separated from the ocean by a narrow fjord sill with a measurable exchange of material between the fjord and the ocean. The producer and consumer, or the phytoplankton and the zooplankton dynamics in that system were almost identical to those I've just shown you for Daphnia, obviously with different parameters, but the same kind of function. They had a set of top consumers, which were jellyfish, which were predominantly jellyfish, so they now had a system in which the consumer dynamics really did matter. They were not in the position that they could independently parameterize all their models, but this is really what I want to get at in terms of testing. They chose one, which was a place called Loch Creran in the west of Scotland. By fitting as much as they could, by taking as much as they could from the lab, by fitting the rest from Loch Creran, they got themselves a set of model parameters. They now had a hypothesis that said, we're going to go to other places, and the other places we're going to assume have identical biology, but different hydrodynamics. And these were systems in which quite a lot about the physical oceanography was known. That's it, people had studied stratification in these fjords, they had studied the water exchange. So these curves represented fitted data for, I've just chosen two variables, phytoplankton and dissolved nitrogen. They then went to two other places, put in externally determined hydrodynamic parameters, and as you can see, for phytoplankton and locative did not too badly. For dissolved nitrogen, they actually did quite badly. They got this is a significant difference in Lochar-Var, the situation was the opposite, that the limited nitrogen information was consistent with observation, but they predicted a second phytoplankton bloom that wasn't there. But my point is that the model constructed according to this philosophy gave you a system. It finished up being about 8 coupled ordinary differential equations instead of the humongous simulations that were commonly used. These fits are about as good as people get with the big models, and it's possible, and because everything has a mechanistic basis, it's possible to go back here and ask what is causing this discrepancy, what's missing, and get a pointer to interesting biology. So, to summarize, I've tried to show that by focusing on energy and elemental matter, we can come up with a set of testable models. There's a lot of problems. One I said I would return to at the end, and I'll do so very briefly. The model simplification process has gotten rid of quite a number of potentially interesting nonlinear phenomena. Probably among the more important being the one that somebody over here, I can't remember who the question was, highlighted earlier, which was the fact that my picture assumes that organisms can shrink indefinitely. And in reality, the ability to shrink is related to size. And we've done lots of simulations with that kind of thing in, but it certainly creates interesting dynamics. Ecologically, there are many challenges with the Daphnia system, probably the most important being that I cheated when I showed you the equilibria from the field in one respect, which is the really simple model does predict the equilibria I showed, that was honest, but it also predicts that at least part of the range of the x-axis, it's unstable, and it predicts limit cycles that are not observed in most systems, and we have to understand that there's an extra stabilizing factor in a lot of natural Daphnia systems that is missing from our model, and there's a very long paper by the Gang of Five of us that I can summarize by saying it lists a very large number of phenomena that are not the cause of stability, and the cause of stability is yet to be determined. And then as we add even a little complexity to our system, we potentially get complex dynamics, including the possibility of multiple attractors in a number of these systems. And just to establish that, that is not a purely mathematical amusement, I'm again showing a picture here from, again, a publication by the group of us. These were experiments on Daphnia in aquaria in Ed McCauley's lab. So we're now talking about systems with self-regenerating food, but nothing other than phytoplankton and Daphnia in the system. He found that some replicates went into large amplitude cycles of the sort that simple models predict. Others went to a stable equilibrium, and there were a few that switched between one and the other. And you can, there is very different demography associated with this situation than with that situation. He did an experiment that showed that intermittent production of resting eggs played some part in the stabilization of these populations, but we don't yet have a mechanism that says why that is how that would fit into our simple modeling framework. Let's say we have elaborate models that give us multiple equilibria. We don't have a real simple model that we can give you a just-so story about that gives you multiple equilibria. timescale. These are, that is Julian dates. So that's a, so that means from a, so the horizontal axis is dates, is days. So a, this is the 150th day of the year, a, running through to, so Adrian, 90 days, something like a, something like that along the, a, along the axis. And I, that's, that, that, as far as I, what I want to say, that's a, that's pretty much it. It's a, in a sense, an advertisement for a particular approach with a side message that simple models can be taken a, perhaps more seriously than sometimes a, they're given credit for. And I interrupted a question. I'm saying, I'm primarily making the, I'm cutting through a lot of detail. I'm arguing that I'm more interested in the blue curve than in the green curve because I understand it better. This is the population of the Daphnia. What I've called a stable system can be, actually means a stable system or small cycles. And these cycles are certainly a much larger a amplitude than the others. When you set up a full age structured model and look at simulations, it turns out that there are two mechanisms that generate cycles. One is prey-predator cycles, which are just like you see in some of the ordinary differential equation models. The other is generation cycles, which means that you're getting a little blip. You're getting small amplitude cycles whose period is approximately equal to one generation. And you could think of that as being almost like a resonant response of a lightly damped system. If you cause a birth of reproduction in a system for whatever random reason, you typically get an echo of it. We're in UC facing tidal wave 2, which is in a sense an echo of previous demographic events and so on. And I think I'm arguing that, yes, a test would certainly tell you that these were cyclic, but the studies of the demography we've done suggest that they're these generation cycles and are related to these generation cycles, whereas these have a different mechanism and are large amplitude prey-predator cycles. And I'm a more precise way of saying what I was talking about is I don't understand why you can get these and these in the same system. I can give you a zillion models that tell you for some parameter values you'll get these and for other parameter values you'll get these. But I don't have models that give you possible coexistence of the two. All right, and that's a... Yes. Yeah, well, there is a... The periodicity is particularly frustrating in Daphnia because if you take the really simple model that I wrote down and forget about generation cycles and you ask what would be the period, a back of an envelope calculation of the period obtained by just linearizing about equilibrium and getting the angular frequency on the stability boundary, you get about 30 days. Give or take, as the period coming out, anything between 20 and 40. You now look at the various types of demographic cycle I'm talking about. If the development time is between 10 and 20 days, generation cycles will have a period of that plus about a mean adult lifetime, which takes you to anything up to 20 plus days. Delayed feedback cycles, still driven by demography, but relating to, for instance, strong food dependence and fecundity that does not have its counterpart in growth, would give you cycles of a period of double that. It's just an everything is coming in a fuzzy way in the range, say, 20 to 50 days. From a mathematical point of view, that maybe says there's some interesting coupling there, but it's very different from some of the insect systems I've seen looked at where prey predator cycles would come out with a period of hundreds of days, and the generations would be tens, and you just, you know, it's a no-brainer to look at them and say what kind it is. I base my comment here about the demography related to the fact that we've looked at the juvenile adult ratios over time in these systems and in these systems, and in fact we used these as the diagnostic for saying that the dynamics were different. No, the time dependence was not important in that case, but we've done simulations with time dependence and it doesn't change the story. There it's a variant of what I put up there, which is that if you had the open species on its own, the model says it would pull the resource down to a certain level. That is a level at which the closed species can grow from zero. So the closed species can invade a system in which the resource is at equilibrium with the open species. The open species can obviously always invade because it's being supplied. So a hypothetical system in which seasonality has been removed, in a hypothetical system from which seasonality had been removed, you would get coexistence. We've then numerically checked that introducing the seasonality has a relatively small effect, in this case, on the predictions. So in a sense, it's the obverse of the case I talked about with the Daphnia, where the fluctuations were the key to coexistence. Here, the fluctuations almost certainly influence precise parameter values for coexistence, but the big picture can be understood without thinking about the fluctuations.
On the role of space, you mentioned that you study the spatial-dependent models. If you have some such an invader, you could think of a lot of mechanisms that would make this model actually sort of spatial-dependent. Say there are things like that are occupied by the regular species, or how the temporal species, the spatial distributed, is influenced by the other one.
I think there's two issues. This is a general point about population modeling. If you ask me in the context of the salt marsh, I don't know. And the reason is that there is a migration. This is what I was going to put up here. There is a migration of the open species towards the mouth of the marsh as the year as the year wears on. But in general, I think you can address the question of space in population dynamics at two levels. There are some systems for which I think true explicit space is really critical to understanding the dynamics. And there's others for which what some ecologists call pseudospace, which really just means some form of heterogeneity, is essential. That's to say there are a lot of models of competition for which what really matters is that the habitat is split up into regions, some of which are some of which have different productivities from others. So the heterogeneity of the environment matters, but the distribution of these patches in space is of no consequence. There are other mechanisms that actually rely on the spatial arrangement of the interacting systems. For instance, we have, as an example of the first kind, we've developed a body of theory of a consumer resource interactions which are applicable to, for instance, snails moving around on the surface of on the bottom of a river where they're scraping algae, and every place they go they drop the population to zero. What that says is, if you look at a photograph of the system, you see a whole lot of snail trails. If you try to characterize the system by a mean equilibrium density, you get a value which is equilibrium density of food, that is, you get an average which is made up of a lot of zeros and a lot of quite high values. you can get much better fits of experimental data to models if you have a model where you imagine space is made up of a lot of small patches, each, if you like, one bite size. But it turns out the spatial arrangement of these patches in that particular system is not that important. So there are, so I would proceed again in two steps. I'd say there's systems for which heterogeneity is important, but space isn't. And there are other systems for which spatial arrangement is potentially critical. Yes.
Images about resource protection. Mm-hmm. Is that mostly the story? I don't know anything
about this field.
Is
it biological about it's certainly not. You know, if you go to different ecologists to talk, they would not all come up with the same emphasis. So in a sense, it's my slanted. It's related. You know, for this talk, and it's related to. It's related to a bunch of questions, of specific questions. If I go back, maybe I can answer that best by going right back to the beginning and making another remark. I commented right back at the beginning that ecologists worked at all these four levels of ecological organization. If you just went out and looked in the literature related to each of these, what you'll find is quite surprising. Because a lot of the literature on individuals is physiological, a lot of the measurements and so on that are out there are physical, chemical in nature. So you will find a lot of emphasis on elemental matter and transformation and chemical transformations and so on in this literature. At the ecosystem level, you will find the same thing. That's to say, people are looking in many ways at a complicated system as if it was a physical chemical reactor. And in between, there is this focus on individual organisms and populations, numbers, size structure, and so on, that takes no account of the physical chemical variables. I've emphasized these variables because they give you a possibility of making conceptual and quantitative links all the way through here. But there's a whole lot of questions you cannot address with the kind of thing that I've done. For instance, the models that I've talked about, taken literally, give you the size structure, or the age structure at least, of not so much the size structure, but the age structure of a lot of the populations completely wrong. And that's because this assumption of constant per capita mortality, which is not too much of a deal when you're dealing with biomass dynamics, is a disaster when you're after age structure. So if you're after situations that depend on age structure, then the approach I've talked about here is a really bad one. Likewise, with community interactions, there are some interactions, especially those that have a strong behavioral component, that it is hard at present to describe in exclusively biomass or elemental matter related terms. But I think they're always part of the story because these considerations are always constraining what can happen. In a sense, conservation of energy and thermodynamic principles are sitting there as a constant backdrop to to what's going on, but they're certainly not the whole story.
Okay.